Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, the 4th of September, 1999. We're in the Fireside Room this morning in Koinonia. Your presenter's name is Cynthia Molibito. Today's session number is 99-5 and is entitled Christian Mysticism and Subversive Power. Let's listen in.
Doing this session, just I need to know before we begin how many people have not been to previous sessions, just to get a sense of that. Okay, good. It's nice to have a member of the younger generation here. To introduce myself to those of you who are new, I'm a doctoral student in Christian ethics at Union Theological Seminary, and the work that we're doing here together grows out of that, my work there in part, but also my work as a missionary in Honduras and as the director of the Center for Global Education's DC office. All of those activities in my life opened my eyes to some of the realities of economic inequity around the globe, and those experiences feed into these sessions. For the sake of those who haven't been here before, I'd like to spend just a couple of minutes reviewing what we've done, very briefly reviewing what we've done in the past sessions, and then move on to brand new material. In sum, what we have been doing is struggling with a contradiction that has ripped my guts for about 20 years, since I first saw a movie in Luther League about the impact of Gulf Western, a major corporation, on the people of the Dominican Republic. And I saw people suffering horribly, and my life as a 15-year-old Lutheran girl was changed, and things continued on when I spent time in Latin America and other things. But the contradiction that we're dealing with is this. We are a people called to love neighbor. And we are called to, as the Deuteronomic historian says, choose life. I set before you blessing and curse, life and death, choose life, so that you and your descendants might live. So here we are, both called and graced with the gift of life, which serves neighbor and chooses life for creation. This is our calling, this is our desire, and most of us here, I'm sure, long to live that way. Live lives which do love our neighbor and our earth, our neighbor throughout the globe. Yet, we find ourselves in this horrible position of being locked into ways of life determined by global economic systems, ways of life which essentially brutalize poor people throughout the world and destroy our earth. And the systems that force us into brutal ways of life also enable us to continue a lifestyle which is terribly consumptive and which allows a few, a very small wealthy elite, to consume enormous amounts of wealth in their hands. And we haven't gone into statistics justifying my claim that the economic ways by which we live are brutal. What we've done is share some stories, and the stories have been many. The shortest one, and the one that has burned me the most in my life, is the voice of a Mexican strawberry picker who said to me, "You know, our children die because our land grows strawberries for your tables, rather than growing beans and corn and vegetables for our children." And his voice represents millions around the world. So this is the contradiction we've been struggling with. We're called to love neighbor, and here we are locked into life ways which spell death for many. And I've suggested that we deal with two questions. One, why do we acquiesce? Why do we comply? Why do we agree to this kind of economic setup, rather than standing up and calling out that this is an affront to our faith and we say no? Why do we agree? And secondly, where in our Christian faith tradition do we find the power to resist ways of life which are destructive and to revision alternatives and live towards them? What we've done in the past four sessions is really deal with, first, we kind of unpacked those two questions. And secondly, we dealt with the first question. And the line of response that we dealt with is this. I suggested that economic globalization in its dominant paradigm, which is corporate driven and is oriented around deregulating all kinds of international trade and investment. This paradigm of globalization really disables, corrodes, undermines our power to live toward our calling, which is to love in the ways that we live. And we've talked about ways in which our moral power is disabled by globalization. Now we have one time left just to go down the path of the second question. That is, where do we find moral, spiritual power to resist and rebuild alternative ways? And I am going to suggest that in the face of seemingly impenetrable economic injustice and other forms of injustice in our world, that there are many, many rays of hope. And that those rays of hope are offered, one, by little-known people throughout the globe who have begun to envision alternatives and live toward them. And rays of hope are found in the great faith traditions, our tradition, the Christian tradition, the Jewish tradition, and others, offer wellsprings of hope for us, and that our job is to plumb the depths of those traditions. And so I'd like to suggest one way of plumbing the depths of the Christian tradition today. I'd like to put a little period there for a minute and maybe take a footnote and just kind of contextualize this whole inquiry in a way of looking at the Christian moral life, our task. Well, the Christian theological life, the faith life, looking at our task as theologians. I would say that all of us who reflect on our life with God are theologians, and that our task is to take the current crises and reflect on it in the light of our tradition. And I would just lay out four steps in that reflection. One is to ask what's going on, and that is to gain economic literacy, to begin to understand the mechanisms of our economic life. Two is to ask why. And that is, again, to dig into the power dynamics at play and to look at the ways in which our Christian tradition, our theology, has played into structuring domination, has played into racism, has played into economic injustice. Three, to ask, how can things be different? What are alternatives? And four, to ask, where is the power to live towards those alternatives? And it's that fourth piece that we're looking at today. Okay, that's all by way of sort of reviewing what we've been at, where we've been at in these four sessions. I'd like to stop and just make time for questions and reflection on our past reflections, but I'd like rather just to go on and step into new territory and then make time for questions about the new material that we're going to cover at a later point. But I would say, and our modus operandi has kind of been, when you have questions or comments, don't wait till the end. Just, you know, pitch in, pipe in, and that's made our discussion rich. So please, I invite you to do that. When we turn to our Christian tradition and we ask, wherein lies hope for moving towards alternative ways, I think the first thing we find is we find many norms and principles, mandates about how to live. That is tremendously important, and I don't negate the importance of that. I simply think it's not enough. That we need to go beyond looking at the moral norms and principles in our tradition and ask, where does our tradition offer power? Power to live in alternative ways. I would dare guess that that many of us here could recite or could suggest ways in which our faith offers us suggestions about how to live otherwise, how to live towards economic justice. We can look at commandments, we can look at the Jubilee year, we can look at many things. But I'd like us to step beyond that and take a glimpse at, where do we find the power to live those ways? When our society is beckoning us to acquire more, as you were saying, I can't remember your name.
Justin,
last week or yesterday, that even when we want to live differently, all of these forces in society compel us to define ourselves by how much we have, that we're successful if we have money. How do we have the power to resist those notions? Or like you were saying, Candace, the incredibly overwhelming powerlessness that we can feel when we realize that peasants throughout the world are dying to produce our snow peas and our strawberries and the minerals for our military production. We become overwhelmed with powerlessness. Or as another friend of mine said, Cindy, I feel muted and dwarfed by it all. It seems to me, or as you were saying, Alex, anesthetized by this incredible drive to continue on a trajectory of consumption and acquisition. Where do we find the power to not be anesthetized and not be overwhelmed with powerlessness, not be driven along the path of defining ourselves by having a remodeled kitchen instead of a cruddy old-fashioned kitchen, or a decent dining room table instead of a cruddy old one? I simply believe that our faith tradition offers power. And as I began to look at, I got glimpses that we should look into our history, and we should look at the tremendous power that was known by faith forebearers throughout history, whose faith in Christ enabled them to resist forces of domination that seemed equally powerful as the forces of economic injustice and other forces of injustice in our society today. I wonder what would happen to our sense of being people of tremendous moral spiritual power to resist if we located ourselves in community with the ancient resistors. If we saw that not only are we in community with middle-class mainstream churches today, but we're in community with the ancient tradition of resistance who stood up against forces of domination. This is our community. What if we taught our children that these are our forebearers? Take a minute to think. If you think about your tradition and locate it not as starting just 2,000 years ago with Christ, but as starting many thousand of years ago with the Hebrew tradition, starting with the stories in the Bible, who are your ancestors, your forebears that were resistors of forces of domination in their world? Can you name some of them?
The 11th chapter of Hebrews just kicks off.
Okay, kick off some.
It goes through a whole list, beginning with Abraham or Noah, and it goes through a whole list of Old Testament witnesses.
Okay. Okay, who are some of those Old Testament resistors?
My daughter's named after Susanna.
Susanna, who is she?
She was it's kind of a long story to some people.
Well, make it a little short story. How did she resist domination?
Well, some men wanted to rape her. She was in a garden, and some men wanted to rape her, and they told her if they weren't allowed to, that they would take her to court and she would be put to death, but she wouldn't let them. She just and she went to court, mm-hmm. and they believed her.
Oh,
actually, which is what is amazing.
Oh,
times.
So somehow her courage enabled the voice of truth to stand up to power, to speak truth to power and be heard.
In a woman.
Mother Jones.
Mother Jones.
Queen Esther.
Joan of Arc. Mm-hmm. Joan of Arc. Other resistors, pardon me?
Tamar.
Good. Are there others?
Martin Luther King Jr.
Simone Weil.
Pardon me?
Simone Weil.
Simone Weil, excellent.
Sojourner Truth.
Moses and Miriam and the brave Hebrew midwives who resisted the domination of the Pharaoh. Others?
Rosa Parks.
What about also the early Christian communities, who some of whom, not all of whom, Rome demanded that they bow down and they refused?
Perpetua,
one of the early first century or early second century resistors. Mm-hmm. I mean, get this, the notion that instead of declaring Caesar is Lord, and rather saying Jesus is Lord, they didn't just face death. I mean, death is pretty easy to face compared to death by torture. Mm-hmm. And something gave them to power, the power to face death by torture.
With their family.
With their family. Mm-hmm. They are throughout our history. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the Central American Christian, pardon me?
Downtown their comrade in Brazil, he just died last week.
Uh-huh, excellent.
Yeah.
Oscar Romero.
And not only Martin Luther, and not only, for instance, Camara and Oscar Romero, but also the nameless multitudes that walked with them. Not only the big names, but attached to each of these names, most of these names that we've named, are many, many nameless multitudes who also, whose names we don't remember, who weren't big-time figures, but who, in some certain way, through faith in and of Jesus Christ, decided that the powers that be could not get them to conform. Now, this is our heritage. So if the powers that be are demanding that we and our children agree to wear shirts made in sweatshops, play with soccer balls made by little boys who die at age 10 because they make soccer balls 15 hours a day in the dark, to eat strawberries, to spend as much in a year on cosmetics and ice cream, as much money as it would take to provide food, water, and health care for every person on earth who doesn't have it. I mean, this is the life that we live. If the powers that be say that this is the life we must live, something in our heritage says no, it is not. And I think that it's that something that we need to learn to draw upon. As I've began to study many...
That's not power.
Pardon me?
That's not power, that's just information.
I don't know what you mean. It's not power, it's information.
Well, finding out who has done that in the past and saying, well, isn't that nice?
Okay, good point. That's not power, it's information. So if we see ourselves as in community with these resistors, that's one step. If we go beyond the information that they existed, and start to see them as guides, as spiritual moral guides for us, that's another step. And as we begin to explore some of them as spiritual moral guides, as I have begun to explore some of them, it has become clear to me that many of them were mystics in a profound sense, in the sense that they believed that God dwelled in them. We're not going to get into a big discussion of what mysticism is, but one form of mysticism is the experience of the divine within. I'd like to read to you a couple of paragraphs of what I want to say because I don't want to skip anything, and if I don't read it, I'll forget certain things. So bear with a little bit of red word. My guides that I have been drawing upon are Irenaeus, a second century theologian who resisted one of the worst persecutions by Rome that occurred. Another is the Beguines, a community of medieval women who resisted the Pope's sole claim to truth and salvation. Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Martin Luther are the founder of our church. While the mysticism of each of those figures is distinct, all of them claim that the God of the cosmos takes fleshly form among and within human creatures, dwelling in union and communion with us, loving us with God's love, which becomes our love and conforms us to the form of Christ. Where we may assume we have little power against forces of domination in our world, these ancestors' experience of union with Christ engendered in them passionate love, which undermined forces of domination in their worlds, even at the cost of life. They challenge our lack of moral power, and they breathe to us about alternatives. I suggest that for the long term, not for just today or tomorrow, but for the long term, we journey into the Christian mystical traditions asking this: in what ways do they inspire and guide our quest for moral power in the face of economic systems that force us to participate in murder? How did they come to embody the living Christ and, as Irenaeus said, to drink the dew of God's Spirit diffused throughout all the earth, to such an extent that they defied systems of domination and lived toward alternative realities? I believe we have before us a constellation of guides, a whole family of guides that can draw us and lead us into ways of faithful, loving, compassionate resistance in the name of Jesus Christ. Martin Luther is one of those guides. We could go into a whole bunch of discussions right now about Martin Luther and about the things that I have been reading in Martin Luther that might differ from what we've all learned before. And I don't want to go into a lot of controversial discussion of Martin Luther right now, but I want to suggest to you a few things that I read in Luther the mystic, that enable him to serve as a guide for us towards ways of resistance. Does that make sense, or do I need to stop for a minute for some questions, problems, disagreements?
Concerns? Follow on Bud's comment that knowing that there were resistors in the past doesn't make me a resistor in the present.
Uh-huh. Okay.
What makes me a resistor in the present is what I understand to be the topic of today.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we can maybe learn is still just information. How did they behave? Where did they get their power from?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Community,
mm-hmm.
you know, a discipline of hours of prayer each day.
Mm-hmm.
These are things that I don't have.
Okay.
I am powerless because I am not in a community and I don't pray at least an hour every day.
Well, that's a tremendous question that does move right on Bud's question. Where do we move from knowledge to power? Martin Luther has specific answers to that. He has really, really specific answers, and I asked him that question. Let's progress towards it.
Yes.
But definitely get to it. Alex.
Taking the other side of that, I don't always do well with a list of do's.
Mm.
These things, doing them individually, communally, will, et cetera, et cetera. Those are important and they work at times. I have a hard time with that. What for me brings more comfort and seems to be more regenerative is to know that within me, though dormant as it often is, lies the dunamis that allows me to be that which I need to be in the area of justice and mercy.
Lies the dunamis?
The power.
Oh, the power, huh?
Yeah, the power. It is there. All that is needful is already there. And it reminds me that it is there and it can be appropriated, and it convicts me to seek to appropriate it so that it can live itself through me. So I value that reminder. And I try to hold the being in balance with the doing.
I would just prefer, what comes to me is that I would go with the pursuit of Orthodox Christianity rather than the one segment, namely the mystical tradition. I'm certainly only listening to what you
have. Okay, right, and we've talked about that a little. Good. I would like to, we will go forward with what we're thinking about saying, but it's in conjunction with, it is, I would say this is Orthodox Christianity. I would say that what I'm planning to talk about is very Orthodox Christianity, in the broad sense of Orthodox. And let's just hold intention, and not intention, but more in unity, this notion of how do we do to ignite, to catalyze our power, and how do we also remember that it's there in our very being. And I do want to get to some of the specific do's, because I find them fascinating, particularly in Luther, since that's the church we're in. I'd like to make two points about Martin Luther to begin with. One is that, you know, we've learned a lot about justification by grace through faith alone, and a lot of it has taught us that somehow it's not tremendously related to the moral life or to works. But I would suggest that for Luther, justification by grace through faith alone has enormous transforming impact on the Christian moral life. And by the moral life, I mean how do we live in this world on a daily basis. The impact is this of justification. The power to actively serve the well-being of the neighbor by the ways in which we live our everyday lives comes to live in us through justification. Not all of a sudden, but progressively. The spiritual moral power with which we are filled gradually transforms us and is actually the presence of Christ in us. I want to unpack that a little bit. That is inherent in and inseparable from justification. It's not just a matter of being made right with God in terms of being forgiven by God. It's also a matter of being transformed by God into neighbor-loving people in every way that we live. The second point is that for Luther, the Christian moral life, how we live out our faith, demands economic practices that are diametrically opposed to global capitalism today. He establishes moral norms, economic norms, that flatly refute the newly emerging capitalism of his day and the advanced global capitalism of our day. And those moral norms are directly related to his belief that we come to be in union with Jesus Christ. Those are my two points. Together they come to be something like this. The crucified and living Christ, given as a gift to dwell in us, gradually transforms us into neighbor-serving love which staunchly resists any form of domination that obscures God's word or demands disobedience to God's way of life. Christians are first objects of Christ's love. Christ loves us, and then we become subjects of Christ's love. We love with Christ's love. As bearers of Christ, we live in ways oriented around the well-being of neighbor, far and near, and we defy economic practices aimed at maximizing profit rather than at serving the well-being of the other. Pastors ought to preach against economic injustice. Where much of North American and European Lutheran tradition has kind of put the concrete moral life on the back burner, Luther kept it smack on the front burner. And we've misread Luther not to see that. What I would like to do is just look a little bit about what Luther says about union with Christ, Christ coming to dwell in us. Secondly, look at what Luther says about economic life. And third, look at how those two things together might inform our power to resist economic injustice today. Does that make sense for everyone? Okay. Let me read to you a couple of excerpts from sermons by Luther, very brief excerpts, that talk about us coming into union with Christ. Now, the context of this is important because Lutheranism has often said that I won't say what Lutheranism has said, but hear this in contradiction to, or hear this in relationship to what we have normally been taught about Luther's notions of salvation. These are two sermons which speak to our becoming divine, our partaking of the divine in Luther's terms. He writes, "This is one of the exceedingly great promises granted to us, that we should become partakers of the divine nature, and should be so highly honored as not only to be loved by God through Jesus Christ, but even have the Lord himself dwelling completely in us. Then, regarding one in whom God dwells," Luther writes, "that one makes daily progress in life and good works, is useful to God and humanity. Through that person, humans and countries benefit. Filled with the fullness of God means full of God, adorned with God's grace and the gifts of the Spirit, who illuminates us with his light, lives within us, saves us with his salvation, enkindles love within us, having God and all his blessings dwelling in us in fullness, and being effective to make us wholly divine. Through faith in Christ, Christ indeed is one with us. Through Christ's love, we are changed to make the infirmities of all others our own, We are to take upon ourselves their form and necessity, and all the good that is within our power we are to make theirs. We are changed into one another and made into a community by love. Luther insists in other places that in becoming divine, in becoming bearers of Christ, we don't leave behind our earthly, creaturely, bodily selves. That's completely contrary to what Luther teaches. And there are many ways in which Luther does contradict medieval theology. One of those ways being that somehow in becoming godlike, we leave behind our bodily, earthly natures. That's not Luther. Luther revels in the fact that we are very embodied, bodily, earthly creatures. And in becoming bearers of Christ, we don't leave that behind. We don't ascend into somehow simply spiritual and moral beings. We are spiritual, moral, bodily, earthly beings. The implications for Luther of our being bearers of Christ are pretty profound. One of the implications has to do with our economic lives. Although we don't always know it, one of Luther's main concerns was economic justice. And here I read from one of the editors of Luther's works, you know, mainstream Lutheranism. Luther's great concern was for justice and equity in the economic sphere. Luther wrote three treatises and spoke in many, many other articles and did many sermons on economic justice. And what we need to do is take a brief look at his context to get the magnitude of the implication of his writings on economic justice. His was a time of economic revolution, transforming Germany from a nation of peasant agriculture into a society with at least the beginnings of a capitalist economy. The consequences, and look at the parallels today, to today, the consequences included high prices, growing disparity between rich and poor, increasing poverty, especially amongst those with fixed or small incomes. The poor were seen as a cheap labor pool for an expanding profit economy. Poverty was a growing social problem, and increasingly large-scale international trade required capital, which sought profitable investment, feeding capitalist economics and financial contracts. So the ethics of investment and trade were on the forefront. Investment and trade are what we're talking about today as the crux of the deregulation of investment and trade are the crux of the capitalist economy today. In that context, Luther denounced economic exploitation. He argued that the source of poverty was not the feudal system, but the new profit economy. He condemned the emerging free trade economy and beseeched political leaders to do the same. When you read Luther's works on economics, you note something startling. That's that he establishes norms for just economic life for Christians and other norms for non-Christians. And you begin to ask, why are there certain norms for Christians that seem very contradictory to the emerging capitalist economy? And you begin to see that it's because Luther believes that Christians, but not other people, have the moral power to live according to those norms. And before we look at those norms, just take a moment to think about the implications of that. Christians can live according to economic justice because they have the power of Christ dwelling in them, empowering them to do that. Does that say anything to us about our life today?
Well, I think that's pretty profound, eh?
Meaning what?
Well, I just think that, you know, I have non-Christian friends and I have Christian friends, and I'm just blown out by that. That's I can see it, I guess. That's sad. It's just sad. I think that statement is.
And in a certain sense, it is. Just one moment. I do want to be really clear that I am not saying that Christians have, that other people don't have this as much moral power as we have. That's not my claim. other people can, non-Christians in other traditions can claim moral power as profound as ours. I'm not belittling the moral power of other people. I'm simply saying that, according to this forebearer, there is a particular form of moral power that is defiant of economic injustice, and it's the power of Christ in us. Evelyn.
It was interesting to me in 1983, which was Luther's 500th anniversary, for those of us who went to East Germany, Deutsche Demokratische Republik, that Luther was a big hero, and you would find his quotations about economic life all over the place. They were celebrating Luther. However, I think, why did that system fail? I mean, they had some of the economic ideas, but they did not have the moral power of Christianity, so that the system fell in on itself. And I think, we considered it dangerous because it was socialist, it was communist. Nothing wrong with the statements, but the wrong moral power and the wrong motivations.
But an awful lot of Christians supported that system.
Yeah.
And I don't think we in America are ever willing to accept that there were a couple of hundred million Christian communists in this world not too long ago.
And they were Christians.
No, and I think that's a given that we're slowly coming to see in many, many contexts, that there are many communists around throughout the globe that have also been Christians. That communism isn't diametrically opposed to Christianity, it's diametrically opposed to capitalism.
And things have gotten so much worse, and exactly what you're talking about, since there is no longer communism, but any kind of a viable alternative to capitalism.
Well, that's another good point that we've been discussing, is that it's one of our mistakes is to think that we have only two alternatives, Soviet-style capitalism or Soviet-style communism or U.S.-style capitalism. Those are not the only alternatives that the world can look towards. Woody?
I'll ask a clarifying question. You're saying what Luther is, has a two-tiered system of moral behavior, or as behavior as a resistance against this kind of capitalism. And he has a higher standard for Christians because he knows that the Christians have a power base which enables them to live to that standard. The lower standard is not because they don't have Christ, but because he doesn't know what they have. He says, I can't expect them, the non-Christian, to have the same strength or source. Maybe they can live up to the higher standard, but it's not to be expected.
Yeah, pretty much so, Woody. And I'm not speaking here about his relationship to non-Christians and their moral life, because that's a whole nother subject matter. But you did paraphrase me quite well in terms of saying that, in terms of economics, he definitely lays out two sets of norms. And the Christian norms, well, let's look into those.
Can I say something real quick? What I see is not this that we have that. Everybody, non-Christians have the moral power. I think the difference is wanting to. We want to, look at this, and this is really important to us, the economic justice, and other people don't. I mean, I don't want to worry about, non-Christian, I don't want to worry about this guy dying for my food. Maybe vain, but I don't care. As long as I get my food or whatever, that's okay. And if I was in that situation, I'd just do the best I can in this system, but they keep driving it forward,
Yes, but I want to be really clear. I don't want to be misinterpreted. Some of the greatest justice fighters throughout the history of humankind have been non-Christians.
Right.
I in no way am belittling the morality, the justice making of non-Christians. I'm only saying that if we claim to exist in this particular tradition, this way of knowing God, that we better stop ignoring what it means and what our ancestors have said about the power of having Christ living in us. But I'm not making a statement that other people don't have moral power. Ron.
Right. For me, just to try to rephrase that, the way it fits for me is that I think we within the body of Christ have given primary responsibility to hold each other accountable to our faithfulness and discipleship of Christ. that is our primary responsibility. It's not to hold everybody in the world accountable to our standards of Christianity. And so, you know, we are here to hold each other accountable to what we understand to be the truth in Christ.
That says it well.
And so whatever happens with all the rest of the people in the world, let it be, and they may be very humanitarian and egalitarian and everything else, but our primary responsibility is for the body, those in the body of Christ.
Right.
And we had best hope that, and expect that, and trust that. Other great faith traditions are, in a sense, doing the same thing, are saying, and they are. I mean, people from many traditions are saying the earth is now at risk. What does our faith tradition have to offer to help to save humanity from going down this path? And maybe one of the great interfaith tasks of our day is the dialogue between faith traditions along this. Let me run down, we don't have a lot of time, let me run down just to strike your fancy, to tickle your fancy, to probe further, let me run down some of Luther's norms for economic life, for Christians. And read these. These all come out of a treatise that he wrote in 1524.
He could have written it in 1924.
Right, he could have written it. And his main purpose, according to his words, is to save individuals from participation in the abuses and sins of trade. Now, those of you who haven't been here before, what we've been talking about for four sessions are the abuses and sins of deregulated international trade and investment. His secondary purpose is to admonish civil authorities to forbid economic exploitation. So some of the norms he lays out. One, buying and selling things is an act in relationship to neighbor. So its goal should not be profit, but rather adequate living for oneself and serving the needs of the other. There's a contradiction. How many companies selling Coke, Nikes, shirts, video games, computer games, cars, and how many of all of us participating in that see buying and selling as an act that's accountable to neighbor love rather than accountable to profit? Does the contradiction glare, or am I imagining it?
I think the key that word there is adequate living.
Very good. And that's very, very key. Yes, adequate. And he makes some definitions about what adequate is also. For example, in a business transaction, how do you calculate how much money, how much profit to take? He says there is no better way then by computing the amount of labor you've put into it, you know, the amount of labor, and calculating what you would pay a day laborer to do that labor. What a day laborer earns to do that work is the amount that you should make. So in other words, he's really, at that moment, contrast that to corporations in which the CEO makes 419 times as much as the lowest paid day laborer. Another contradiction. Secondly, and one of the things we've been talking about in these sessions is that what globalization is doing is removing political, that is public regulation from trade and investment, saying that the public, the political body no longer has the right, governments no longer have the right to establish regulations on trade and investment. That's the trend of globalization. Listen to this norm of Luther's. He argues frequently on theological grounds that economic activity ought to be subject to political constraints. It's political constraints that are being removed from economic activity. This is the main trend of globalization today. He says, selling ought not be an act that is entirely within your own power and discretion, without law or limit. Civil authorities, governments, ought establish, quote, rules and regulations regarding trade. And buying and selling, and ought establish quote-unquote ceilings on prices. Never, and I can read to you right from, we don't have a lot of time, I could read to you about, he denounces selling products for what the market can bear. You ought to never sell what the market can bear. You ought to sell what's at a fair price. He says, Again, there are some who sell their goods at a higher price than they command. There are some who raise their prices of their wares for no other reason than because they know there is no more of that commodity in the country, or that the supply will shortly be exhausted and people must have it. Again, there are some who buy up the entire supply of certain goods or wares in a country entirely under their control. Listen, I'm not going to go into more of that. Let me summarize and say that he denounces selling goods at what the market can bear, because it deprives some of having access to those goods. It deprives the poor of having access to those goods. A third thing. Oh, that was my third one. Buying and selling must adhere to firm rules, one of which is no selling at a price as high as the market will bear. Contrast that to the maxim of neoclassical economic theory. You sell at the price that the market will bear. Fourth, and contrast this to the many people who are terribly disturbed when preachers preach on economic issues. I'm tired of hearing about economic justice in sermons. Lutherans have nothing to do with economics and politics. So contrast this to Luther. Luther admonishes clergy to preach. For Luther, that means to speak the living Christ against economic injustice, and to withhold the sacrament from anyone who exploits others through economic practices unless they repent. For that person is damned like a thief, robber, and murderer, and ought not be buried with Christians. Now, I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that this is the profundity of his denouncing economic injustice.
Where is grace to that statement?
Well, yeah, you know, and you've got to contrast this also with the fact that Luther is full of grace, and someplace else, you know, he's going to read that everyone. So, but I'm only saying that see that he also says this.
Right.
Fifth, and this will be the last one, the church, according to Luther, ought to be an alternative to the emerging capitalist order, refusing to compromise with it, for it, quote unquote, devours the peasants and the urban poor. I could read you a little more of Luther, but I'm not going to. We only have a few minutes.
But he opposed the peasant
government. Oh, Luther did awful things. He opposed Jews, he denounces Jews, he opposed the peasant rebellion. There's no doubt that he was very limited by his social understanding. It was patriarchal, it was constant. I mean, there are many ways that he did many things, but I'm saying that when you look at what Luther said or did, look at the norms underneath it and judge. Does this pertain to our life or does it not? His denunciations of Jews as fundamentally demonic cannot be, we cannot accept that. It does not pertain to our world today. And you look at some of the theological premises underneath that, and they're faulty. So we have to judge his economic norms. Do they pertain to us today? And we have to look at the theological premises underneath them to judge them. And the theological premises underneath Luther's economic norms are a few. There are three or four. One of them is that neighbor love is written together with love for God. Neighbor love is written like on two tablets held forever in front of our face and inseparable. And that neighbor love is not a wishy-washy thing. It has to do with how we live. And that's one of the theological premises underneath his economic norms. A second is, that we are imbued with the power of Christ. And if you read some of his sermons, not his treatises, he talks about a process whereby we are loved by God, and then we begin to love with God's love. And that's the fundamental premise of these norms. What did you say? What was I responding to? Oh, yeah. So I'm not saying just buy everything he says. Believe me, I've been too hard a critic of Luther to ever say buy everything he says. But I do say take it seriously enough to see if it pertains and offers wisdom, insight, and power into our situation today. And I think these do. Much of his economic writing, interestingly enough, is not present in the English translation of Luther's works. It's in German, in his original works, and that's part of why we don't read it as much. Well, pardon me?
Who has control over that?
Well, we could go into that, I suppose. I guess I'd like to say, maybe given that we do have just a little bit of time left, are there ways that you would just reflect on how these teachings of Luther about the moral life, the economic life, differ from what you've heard or learned before, or what is offered to you? What is offered to us in terms of our moral power for resistance by this? Woody, you asked what, and I'm saying something else before I listen to your responses, but you asked how we get to this power. Luther addresses that specifically. I asked him that and looked for the answer. He said, one, we don't pray sufficiently. He says, two, it's only possible in community, only in the Christian community. There is no Christian individual aside from the communion. And another of the things he says is the Eucharist. He rails against the way his people today, German people today, his people, whom he loves, are not practicing ways of economic justice. And it's because they don't practice the Eucharist the right way. They don't take it seriously. In the Eucharist, Christ coming in us, we gain power. So some of the challenges to us are to take seriously the Eucharist and prayer and community. But anyway, that's an aside.
Since Tuesday and I can't get the Eucharist.
Pardon me?
I've been here since Tuesday and I can't
And you can't get the Eucharist. Well, all right. Put
we
that
go
in.
To church every night, can't get the Eucharist.
Does this suggest things to us today? Yes.
Well, I think to look on the positive side, the church that I'm a member of, we've been involved with Habitat for Humanity for about 7 or 8 years now, and what that entails is that we'll enlist a group of volunteers during the summertime and either help to build a house or to last year they remodeled a apartment building, and so it really empowers the poor. It empowers people who would never, they would not have a chance to live in that house unless this Habitat for Humanity existed. So, I don't know, I guess that's on the positive side. That I think that's one of the things that is being done for economic justice. I know it's being done in this country. I don't know if it's being done around the world. I guess I'm not familiar with it enough.
But it seems to be, it's like the homeless. I mean, it's picking the babies out of the water. The system has produced homelessness. Oh, so the churches will go and start giving food and clothing to the homeless rather than change the system.
Right.
The system is not providing housing for the poor. For 30 years since the New Deal, Congress had a commitment to build low-cost housing every year. They hardly ever met their goal, but they didn't quit till Reagan. Then they quit. 2 years later, people are homeless. How did that happen? We will have to start getting some dormitories or something for them. I mean, we never go for the jugular.
Yep. Now, but let's hold those two comments in a positive dialectic. Because you're right. You know, it's the old story. If you see a bunch of babies drowning in the river, do you just pull them out, or do you go around the bend in the river and see who's throwing them in? That's what you're saying, we need to do that. But at the same time, pulling those babies out, serving to do Habitat for Humanity and build is also tremendously good. So I would say to hold both of those in, not an either or, but a positive dialectic, that our Christian life is to be about building houses for the homeless and about challenging the system that creates homelessness. Any others that have not spoken? I don't want to.
I work with poor people. I have a program that offers assistance.
Yes.
And I'm much like his feelings and your feelings. I do both. I find it at times, I'm very tired. I'm battling, I'm hitting my head, you know, I'm praying. I'll pray in the elevator for crying out loud. You know, I'm constantly looking for, not only from our community, our church community, our community within our city, or the other community agencies, or whatever. I'm also looking for our government and our state, and exactly saying, but you don't get it. I mean, what is it that you don't see? I don't get this. And I, you know, and I'm frustrated beyond belief. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm here. And so, and I don't know what to do. I'm one person, and I'm vocal, and I'm loud, and I want somebody to hear me. You know, and all I can do is what I can do, and that is to voice my beliefs and my opinions and see what is happening here. I deal with 15,000 people, uh-huh. and I am overwhelmed. Uh-huh. And I could have 3-4 times the staff and still be overwhelmed. Uh-huh. So what do I do? Uh-huh. I am one uh-huh. voice.
Uh-huh. There's a response to you, I think.
Well, and for me, that says it all. There's a part of Luther's theology that says, you know, come to the community, be fed, be nurtured, and then go out into your daily life and be your voice. But what I think is missing is organizing. Mm-hmm. I mean, we come, go to the community, and then we go out individually, mm-hmm. and yes, we'll do what we think is right to do. But until we become organized, so you no longer have to say, you know, I'm one voice, but rather, we are a voice together. Mm-hmm. That is our power as God's people.
Right. Well, I agree with you completely. I think.
But it takes organizing for it to happen.
And I agree. And I believe that we have an organization. I believe that what we need is the jugular. I really do. I think that this is just beyond even our communities. This is where we need help as a society, not just as a community. The community is there. It's just that society needs to know. Society needs to know that children are being killed by making soccer balls. The community, I mean, we know these things now. Well, society needs to know that these are real, honest to God, daily problems. And homelessness and hunger and poverty is amongst us. It is alive and it is extremely well. And we as a society within the community, as people on this earth, need to go for the jugular. And I don't know what that is. But I'd be more than lucky. I would stand in line.
Well, so you're a wonderful voice, and what you've said speaks loudly and clearly. And you are overwhelmed, but you are also offering vision. You're offering marvelous vision to hear there are others there, and you're saying some things that I think just need to be plucked out and held up. You've talked a lot about seeing clearly and knowing. And this is one of the things we've been talking about here. We've been talking about our call as Christians to see clearly, to have, Jesus said, have you not eyes to see and ears to hear? And that there are specific things we can do to see clearly. We can learn to decode and decipher what is going on. Our political, in the best sense of the word, minds are dumbed down in this society because we don't learn to think critically, and we can. All of us can. And there are ways that you are, and that in you talking about organizing are, and that we can. And I'll, you know, there are resources. I'm going to throw out one because I think that it's important to think about resources for economic literacy. A nationwide organization called United for a Fair Economy. And you can look up their phone number by calling Boston, United for a Fair Economy. Marvelous literature on economic literacy that really talks about what is happening and why. And it sort of helps us to get into the seeing clearly thing. Luther also is a guide in the kinds of things you've been talking about. He organized a totally different system of addressing poverty in his area. Than was dominant in his society, and he wrote 1,000 letters to political power figures about issues in society. So there's a model of organizing an alternative system of sharing economic resources and of doing political advocacy that's right there also in Luther. Two people.
Well, here's an example from, I took the boat yesterday to Stehekin and I got the newspapers to kind of catch up on what's going on. Anyway, the front page of the Seattle paper had a photograph of a vigil for a homeless person that was murdered. And I was just astonished. I've never seen something like that on the front page of a paper. And that really says a lot for, I guess, the Seattle newspaper to carry it, to have something like that on the front page, but to just bring the issue of homelessness to the front page like that in a photograph. I mean, like they say, a picture tells a thousand words. But.
Yeah, and his memorial service is going to be at St. James Cathedral.
Oh, it is. Okay. So, I mean, I was amazed that a picture for a vigil like that would be on the front page.
Were you uncomfortable with that?
A little bit, yeah, because when I visited my friend the other night in Seattle, we walked to dinner, we walked past a couple of homeless people, so, you know, but...
We hope it's just not romanticized theater.
Yeah, and I think it is important. It's very easy for us to sink into the pits of what's not happening, but it is important. Every time there's a glimmer of hope, every time public awareness and consciousness is present, is being brought forth, we should rejoice. We should be glad that we can't belittle even small tokens of Woody and Alan, of hope.
Luther seems to have done his homework. He's organized. He wrote thousands of letters. The 95 Theses he nails at the door of the Roman Church to come up with alternative order. And what you just read about the moral norms, actually thinking about it and actually trying to offer something. The one comment that struck me in the list that really has me been thinking the last couple of minutes was what's a fair price to sell your goods and services for?
Mm-hmm.
And his answer, I mean, that's a question that we all need to wrestle with, and I think that's something we need to do our homework on. When we go and proclaim our economic voice, saying this is what we believe is an alternative to what you're saying, the market, charge what the market will bear is the existing paradigm, and we're saying that's wrong. Okay, if that's not the way to decide the price, how do you decide the price? And he's saying, well, figure out what a day laborer how much labor it would cost to put it into that good or service, and that's the fair price. And I at least that's what I heard you say. Mm-hmm. I'm not necessarily saying that that's the right answer, but I think that's the right question. What is the fair price to charge for goods and services if it's not whatever the market will bear?
And fundamentally, that norm is undoing, completely toppling, subverting, and we've been talking about subversive moral power. It's subverting inequities in wealth. It's subverting the pain, the profit-making. And Luther actually uses incendiary, is that the word, inflammatory language. He denounces the fat cats sitting up beside their harps, doing no work, just roasting their apples and making money by their investments, because he says they suck the life out of a city, a nation, even the world. This language is in... Well, it's either in the, if you want to look it up, it's in the admonition to clergy to preach against, I think it's usury, or it's in trade and usury. But he truly denounces those making wealth off of their profit-making investments.
How can we tolerate one person having wealth equal to 100 million more?
Well, let me call upon someone who hasn't spoken recently. Alex, you had your hand up, and then, and you, sir.
For me, it has become very common to just die in the malaise.
Mm-hmm.
But in the last 5 or 6 years, I've become aware of something that's been going on within the Christian communities in the last 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's called community-based organizing. Mm-hmm. Ron, you must know about that in King County, but Spokane County has been working for a number of years trying to get that off the ground, and they're getting closer. But it involves gathering 15, 20 to 30, 40 mediating institutions that can bring with it its people and its issues It's not an issue-oriented or issue-driven organization in the community. It is based on relationships, people sharing their stories, and out of those come the communal needs and inequities that they're experiencing. And then these churches and other institutions together form a base of power which, after a period of time, hopefully then becomes a viable force within that community, so that they are invited to sit at the table where the decisions are being made to renovate downtown for $100 million. In Portland, for example, when they were doing a renovation project, the Portland Organizing Project by then had acquired such a degree of power that they could lobby City Hall and gain out of that money some millions to form, to provide for low-income housing. And to me, that's a bright light in the dark, where congregations can not only honor the pulling of the drawing person, but can also go up to the bridge and begin to deal with those structures. So if you're going back to your area, whether it's rural or urban, find out if that's taking place, and then encourage your leadership in your congregation to take note and to become involved in such activity. It's very, very effective.
And it's been effective in many, many cities, in rural areas in the U.S.
Industrial Areas Foundation, that's what you're...
You said.
Alex just mentioned something I was going to bring up. I know Alex is very involved in that, in Spokane, but I've studied a lot of economics over the years, and I've never met an economist yet who was not in favor of free trade. And most of them have been market-oriented, although some of them have been pretty liberal in their roles in terms of their externalities of the market. And that's where government's role comes in, to take care of the less fortunate. And we're not doing a very good job of that, even at home, let alone overseas. But I do think that the raising of awareness of some of the things that are going on, like in Kathy Lee's sweatshops, for example, and the people dying building soccer balls, raising awareness, and then this community-based organizing offers some hope for a lot of us becoming more actively involved in changing the system, because it's not the people so much, it's the system. And I think we need to understand that these people, that are, these corporate executives who are making 400 times what their workers are making, they're just playing the game. It's the system. It's not the...
There we go, we have a bell. I do need to say we're actually about 15 minutes over, so simply in closing, let me suggest that we're sort of journeying between worlds here. We're journeying between the world of economic exploitation today and the world of a form of Christian mysticism, the belief that the community is and the people are indwelt by God, and that God gives us power. And I would like to, and that indwelling gives us power to refute and stand up against the domination by which our lives are shaped today. So I would hope that we just go out with an interest in exploring, a bit of a passion to explore further what it can mean for us and for our communities to begin to see more clearly what is going on in the economic systems that shape our lives, to ask why it's going on, and to look for the power that is offered to us by the presence of Christ in us, to resist, to stand within that long and beautiful tradition of resistance of which we are the descendants.